Welcome to Ballistic Radio, the fastest growing gun talk show in the country. Join us. We're going to explore the topics of firearms, self-defense, and your rights as a law-abiding citizen. Ballistic Radio, presented by Blackfire Ordnance Group, makers of TNT and TNT Black. Firearms finishes so tough, you need dynamite to take them off. Now, here's your host, John Johnston.
Welcome to Ballistic Radio, presented by Blackfire Ordnance Group. I'm your host, John Johnston. Remember, you can always listen to past shows at ballisticradio.com and get the latest behind-the-scenes info at facebook.com/ballisticradio. Co-hosting with me today, Matt the Minion. Mr. Minion, how are you?
I'm doing good. How about yourself, John?
Not too bad. I can't complain. It's a lovely, lovely day out right now. We're actually recording this episode just because I'm going to be attending a training event this weekend at Northeastern Indiana with Paul Sharp and Dr. William April. I believe it's the first joint training thing they're doing together. I'm really looking forward to that, and I'm sure I will talk about that on an upcoming show. But since we don't like reruns here at Ballistic Radio, we decided we'd give you a new episode either way. So just a quick reminder, this segment brought to you by Colt. Colt, the legend continues. Tonight we're going to be talking about something interesting, to me at least, that I don't think enough people talk about. A lot of the shootings that you hear about or self-defense scenarios that you hear about with a gun are, I don't want to say typical, because the fact that you're using a firearm for self-defense is not typical in any person's day-to-day life unless you're in a very specific job, but they all tend to look pretty similar with some exceptions, some statistical outliers. And we talk about these things in training, and people are usually aware of them when they happen, but there's not really enough of a discussion about them and their significance. And I think that that is something that is overlooked. I'm going to try and rectify that today. Hopefully it will make sense to people and be something that I don't know why I didn't think about that. Or it could be another one of my ideas that doesn't go nearly as far as I would think of it. But either way, hopefully it'll be entertaining to listen to me ramble for the next 40 minutes about that. I guess where I want to start is Claude Werner, who is someone that I'm a big fan of, has made the statement several different times that in most self-defense scenarios, the fact that an individual is armed is really the only thing that needs to occur for that person to survive that event and come out relatively okay. You know, in a win in that circumstances, do you get to go home to your family at the end of the day?
Now, when you say armed too, are you talking about just with handgun or any sort of weapon, lethal, non-lethal?
Yeah, just armed with a gun.
Okay.
Is generally what we're talking about. I'm sure that there are other instances where, you know, a weapon other than a firearm or even a non-lethal weapon is used to great success, but we'll narrow it down just right now to say if you've got a gun with you, you're probably okay if you need a gun. It doesn't matter what training you've had. Doesn't really matter that much what kind of firearm you've got. And I know that that is really counter to what a lot of people in the industry will say. It's counter to what I'll say for the most part just because, you know, I don't think preparing for the lowest passing standard is necessarily a good thing when we're talking about self-defense. But the fact remains is that most of the time it doesn't matter at all, except when it does. And that except when it does is kind of the part where I think a lot of breakdowns occur, because certain trainers and certain individuals, they acknowledge that that statistical outlier is something that could possibly happen, but I don't know if it's the way they present it or if it's the emphasis that they place on it, but for some reason it comes across as disingenuous to a lot of people, or maybe just sort of fantasy-esque where everyone's got like the Red Dawn scenario where the commies have invaded and now we've got to go get, you know, doesn't seem likely.
Yeah, it's something that could happen, but it seems very, very far-fetched.
Well, and that's the problem, though, is that because it seems far-fetched to people, there's not any thought given to it, or at least not enough thought given to it in my mind. And that, to me, is where a big gap is, I guess, in the community right now. I was having a conversation with someone that's in the medical field, and the firearms industry likes to steal a lot of really good ideas from other fields and industries. You know, when we start examining accidents that occur, the airline industry is a great place to look at how to break down that accident and, you know, things of that nature. Something that I heard about, though, is called a Sentinel event. Sentinel, kind of like X-Men. But no. But a Sentinel event, and in the medical profession, I'll actually read the term. It's an adverse event in healthcare, delivery, or other service, which either leads to or has the potential to lead to catastrophic outcomes. For example, a near miss, thereby often mandating initiation of emergency intervention or of preventative measures. And some examples of that would be, let's say, a doctor prescribes the wrong medication to someone and there's going to be possibly a lethal outcome. You hear it discussed a lot in education of medical students and in other people in the health industry, because as they're talking about case studies and things of that nature, well, they had a Sentinel event, which was where they made a mistake and it could have been something that killed a patient, possibly. I'm going to try and hijack that term and apply it to these events where, when we're talking about something that is a statistical outlier, where it actually does matter what equipment you have and what training you've received to decide whether or not you come out on top of that situation and get to go home to your family, whatever the case may be. I'm going to call that a Sentinel event from here on out. Maybe it'll stick, maybe it won't, but that's how I'm thinking of it. And we see these happen a lot in our day-to-days. Well, excuse me, not in our day-to-days, but when we start looking at self-defense scenarios, the Sentinel events that I've seen are ones that everyone knows about because they're so unusual that they usually cause vast shifts in the training and tactics that either agencies receive or military units receive or even concealed carriers receive. A really good example of this would be the 1996 Miami gunfight that the FBI had. You see all sorts of shifts in thinking and equipment selection based off of things that occurred in that shootout. And what you have is an event that, if it had been approached differently and if equipment had been utilized that was available, the outcome would have been possibly significantly different. Now, it's hard to quantify that. Obviously, what we're doing is using a lot of hindsight and Monday morning quarterbacking, but it's pretty easy to assume that if the agents that stopped the two dangerous armed robbers in the 1986 Miami gunfight had been armed with MP5s and M16s and wearing body armor instead of using 5- and 6-shot revolvers and a pump-action shotgun and one semi-automatic 9mm that was downloaded, things might have gone a little bit differently or better for the agents. There were training issues that occurred, too, that caused the outcome to be negative. Negative as far as what happened to those agents. But you can also that's a very clear case of maybe equipment would have been useful or could have been utilized that, like I said, would have made things better. And usually when you look at gunfights like that or shootings like that that occur, like I said, the training received, the equipment used doesn't matter that much at all because the fact that you're armed usually gets you out of the situation, except when it doesn't. That's actually what we're going to be examining a little bit in this show. I've got a couple of different events that I'm going to bring up. I've also got some questions from last week's episode from the Facebook users that at the end of the show I'm going to try and get to, but like I said, that will be in the next segment. We got to go to break right now, but right now you are listening to Ballistic Radio. Welcome back to Ballistic Radio, presented by Black Fire Ordnance Group, makers of TNT and TNT Black. Firearms finishes so tough you need dynamite to take them off. Visit them online at blackfireordgroup.com. Grip it, love it, get it, the Tough Walther PPX. Then get $100 worth of PPX accessories free. The PPX is Walther's tough workhorse pistol at a value price. Now get an extra magazine, polymer holster, and dual magazine pouch free with the purchase of a new Walther PPX at participating dealers. Grip the famous ergonomic handle and you'll love it. Shoot it and feel the difference. The Walther PPX. Grip it, love it, get it now. Offer good with $9.95 shipping and handling. So today on Ballistic Radio, we are discussing statistical outliers in defensive gun uses. Some examples of that would be the North Hollywood shootout, the FBI gunfight in 1986, some other things that have occurred that I'm going to examine a little bit more in depth and talk about why I think that we should pay a little bit more attention to that in our training regimes, or at least acknowledge that these things occur. I'm calling them sentinel events. I've stolen a term from the medical industry that I think kind of fits and can be applied to these, just because usually when I hear them discussed, it's just like, oh, that was weird. I mean,
yeah,
it's what do you call that? Well, it was strange. And when you're talking about something that is strange in the context of a situation that is already so abnormal that it defies logic for most people, I think that it's earned its own term at that point.
Yeah, there's got to be something to kind of call it and
yeah,
consolidate all the terms or all the events under one term.
Right. And, you know, I've discussed this a little bit with Claude Werner. I discussed it a little bit with Chuck Haggard, too, who will actually be a guest on the show. He's going to make up his episode that he missed on September 28th. And we're actually going to get to talk about sighted and unsighted fire, which I think will be really cool. But I've bounced this idea off a couple of different people, and they – I'm not going to say they agree with me, because I don't want to say that they're putting their stamp of approval on what I'm saying, but they seemed receptive to it, which I certainly appreciate. You know, here's a good example of this. And let's see. June 20th of 1994, a gentleman by the name of Dean Melberg shot and killed four people and wounded 22 others at the Fairchild Air Force Base. Now, that doesn't seem that uncommon. To start, I mean, we unfortunately are living in a time period where mass shootings are becoming something that are sort of just a fact of life. And I don't know if it's necessarily that they've been reported on more often or necessarily why that is. But so I say something like four killed, 22 wounded. Okay, that's, you know, that's not a typical defensive gun use. But we see these mass killings occur. Here's what's interesting about that. Now, the way that this stopped, there was a gentleman, a senior airman, Andrew Brown. He was 25 years old at the time. He was patrolling the base's housing area on a bicycle when he received an emergency call on his radio. He ended up pedaling a quarter mile to the scene and then made a headshot on this guy at 70 yards. With a pistol that he had never shot before. He had drawn it out of the armory that morning, had never fired it. Obviously he was familiar with the Beretta M9. It's a standard sidearm in the military, but he hadn't shot that one. And he ended up firing four shots. Two of them were misses. One of them hit the individual in the shoulder. The other one struck him between the eyes, ending the rampage. That to me is a really good example of where superior training, if not equipment selection, because obviously he was stuck with what he was stuck with, but where superior training comes into play and has a positive outcome on an event that could have been worse. And by could have been worse, generally at a long range engagement, the individual with the rifle has a distinct advantage over the individual with the handgun. That's not any sort of thing that I would want to be involved with, would be taking someone on at 70 yards when they've got a rifle and I've got a handgun.
Yeah, I was going to say, well, I mean, you think when most people go to the shooting range, just typical people, you know, that's not what they train, is shooting at 70 yards, especially trying to make a headshot.
Right. Now, and there's a certain amount of luck that comes into play there, but there's also an undeniable amount of skill that takes place as well. And I'm not saying that we should go out and practice 70-yard headshots or things of that nature all the time. But it is a really good example of an unusual circumstance where, like I said, someone's ability has made quite a bit of impact. Now, here's my problem, and here's why I illustrate this, is that you talk to a lot of trainers, especially firearms trainers or handgun trainers, and they say things like, well, the typical gunfight occurs at 21 feet or closer, so I'm going to focus all my time on that. And I don't disagree that we should focus a significant amount of our time to the more likely scenario, but here's my supposition on that. I've always thought to myself that if I am prepared as best as I can be for the least likely scenario, then hopefully through my preparation for the least likely scenario, I have adequately prepared myself for also the most likely scenario. So when we're talking about going to the range and we do our practice, you know, if you shoot at 7 yards and that's what you shoot, fine. Okay, that's fine with me. The fact that you're actually going out to the range and practicing is better than a lot of people do. But I know a lot of folks that, for instance, will pocket carry a 5-shot J-frame. They don't have a reload. They rarely practice with it, and when they do practice with it, it's at a close range. That's fine. That, once again, using Claude's research as something that we're basing our information off of, I should say, most of the time you'll be absolutely fine with that. The problem is if you find yourself in the middle of one of these Sentinel events, you probably won't be fine with that. In fact, it'll probably be something that gets you seriously injured or killed. And I've actually got some examples of those that we're going to talk about in a little bit. Events where someone's either lack of training or lack of equipment or both caused either serious injury or death.
Well, I was going to say one more thing about that too, John, that I don't know if you thought about it too, but I mean, just the fact that the guy had to bike a quarter mile to get to the scene, you know, obviously he got the call on his radio. He knows what's going on. Adrenaline is pumping. You know,
yeah.
That's not something that many people train for either.
Right.
Just the physical aspect and the fact that, you know.
Well, the physical aspect is something, obviously, that I've been playing with a lot lately just because I spent quite a bit of time in the gym trying to better myself. And I've certainly noticed an improvement in my shooting ability with that as well. But, and, you know, I've discussed this before with other individuals, so I'm not really saying anything original here when I say that most people like practicing the things they're good at and they don't like practicing the things they're bad at. But it is a really good example of things like if you're able to or have the facilities where you can throw some cardio into your training regime and then see how that affects your performance, by all means, do that. It's really good to know where our own limitations lie, and it's certainly good to, like I said, push ourselves a little bit beyond what we're comfortable with and what we practice for on a day-to-day basis. I think that, you know, when you examine that situation in general, there's all sorts of things that guy, you know, Senior Airman Brown did well, extremely well. He got to the scene very quickly. You know, he made a very difficult shot under quite a bit of pressure. Now, I know a lot of people are going to say, and I've mentioned this, that, oh, well, that was a lucky shot. Yes, but it doesn't matter how lucky you are. Most of the people that I know personally, if they're shooting at something at 70 yards, are going to be so far off the mark that luck will not come into it at all. And that's something that I think we need to consider too. So for the folks that carry around, like I said, a 5-shot J-frame, and all of that, or not all of that, I should say, that's all they carry around. Yes, that will get you through most circumstances, but if you find yourselves in one of these statistical outliers, one of these Sentinel events, have you given any thought to that? I mean, if you're already preparing yourself for an event that most people consider extremely unlikely, and most people honestly look kind of askew at folks that carry guns on a day-to-day basis. There are a lot of gun owners that have concealed carry permits that don't carry a gun on a day-to-day basis just because they think it's silly. Or, well, I don't go anywhere that's bad, or, you know, I only carry it when I think I need it. I'm always curious as to what crystal ball that they happen to have that will allow them to predict the future so accurately that they can decide when or when not to carry their gun or, you know, wear their seatbelt or have a fire extinguisher in their house or any of the other things that we do for preparation of an event that could or could not occur, but the stakes if that event occurs are very, very large. And that's, you know, a pretty common saying is that it's not so much the odds, it's the stakes. But if you really stop and think about what that is indicating, it's a really powerful statement, because once again, if you get this wrong, you die. Either you die or your loved ones die or something occurs that can really negatively affect the rest of your life. And if we can prepare for that now, why don't we try and prepare for that now? And like I said, I'll talk about that a little bit more coming up. We've got a couple events that I sort of want to highlight that illustrate this idea a little bit further in my mind. Two of them are actually individuals that I've interviewed on the show. We've got Jared Reston's second officer-involved shooting where he was struck in the face with a .45 caliber handgun round, and that's when he knew the fight occurred. And then also Justin Schneiders, that was shot, I want to say, four times by an individual that was robbing him and a group of his friends. I'll talk about that a little more in the upcoming segments. Right now, you are listening to Ballistic Radio. Welcome back to Ballistic Radio, presented by Blackfire Ordnance Group, makers of firearms finishes so tough you'd need dynamite to take them off. Visit them online at blackfireordgroup.com. This segment brought to you by TopGunSupply.com. TopGunSupply.com is your web source for fine firearms parts and accessories. True product specialists committed to delivering the highest level of customer support to you. They carry top name brands including Ed Brown, Wilson Combat, Les Bear, Sig Sauer, and many more, as well as premium AR pattern rifles. Whether you are looking to protect yourself, are a first-time gun buyer, or a competitive shooter, TopGunSupply.com can satisfy your firearms needs. TopGunSupply.com, your premier source for SIG parts and accessories. So, today we are taking a little bit of time to talk about a concept that I've been working on for a little while, and I've actually got an article that I've been plugging away at that I will hopefully have done in time to release it with this show when it airs as well. But the concept is that of a sentinel event, and what I mean by that is the statistical outliers amongst the statistical outliers. If you look at a defensive gun use, it, just by its very nature, is uncommon. You know, most folks do not ever have to do that inside of their lifetime. So we've got this event that is already a common, and then grouped within that are events that are also uncommon even amongst the uncommon events. You see things like the North Hollywood shootout or the FBI Miami gunfight, or the Fairchild Air Force Base shooting. There's these things that occur that most people do not prepare themselves for, either through training or equipment selection, that while, yes, they are uncommon, if you find yourself in the middle of that situation and you've not properly prepared for it, the consequences can be dire. And we'll take a look at that just a little bit. Now, Jared Reston, someone that I had on the show, I want to say the beginning of December of last year in the first season of Ballistic Radio. And that episode is available on the website, ballisticradio.com. But Jared Reston is a sheriff's deputy down in, I want to say, Jacksonville, Florida. And I apologize to Jared if I'm getting it wrong, but he's been in four officer-involved shootings that I'm aware of now, but his second one was interesting because the first indication that he had that he was in a lethal force event was when he took a contact shot in the mouth with a .45 caliber handgun. And I know a lot of people like to treat .45 caliber ammunition as if it's some sort of death ray that will go back in time and kill the target's parents and, you know, rape their dog or whatever. But obviously, handgun rounds in general suck. This is a really good example of it, just as an FYI. So, but Jared was struck in the face with a handgun round. He fell down an embankment, was lying kind of at the bottom of this embankment. The guy's standing up at the top of it, shooting down at him, and Jared gets mad. That's essentially what happened. Now, also, too, he had already been involved in one shooting at this point. He was in full uniform, so he had a complement of tools that, you know, possibly are not common for the average concealed carry individual to have. He was carrying a full-size service weapon with a weapon-mounted light, which actually comes into play in a little bit. And I know we've been talking about the usefulness of a weapon-mounted light on a handgun for a civilian. I actually thought of something after that question got asked last episode that has to do with this event that I think that not many people think about. So anyway, Jared draws his sidearm and starts making shots on this individual. Keep in mind, he's shooting one-handed. He's already been struck, I want to say, 6 or 7 times.
I was going to say, and the guy, wasn't he coming towards him still firing at him?
Yeah, yeah. Well, he was firing over his shoulder, I want to say, and when he saw that Jared was still alive, turned around and was coming back at him, still shooting. And like I said, the one that hit him in the mouth was not the only one that hit him. So anyway, Jared shoots this individual, and in the episode, it's interesting because he talks about remembering seeing his front sight settle down into the rear notch of the rear sight.
I was just going to ask you, did he find his sights?
Yeah, he used his sights. Go figure. Yeah. But we'll talk about that more on the 28th when we have Chuck Haggard on. But because Chuck's an interesting individual just because he ran Topeka, Kansas firearms training program for, I want to say, 3 years. And he had over 80%. Hit rates with his officers that were involved in shootings. I want to say that 9 of them over an 18-month period were 100% hit rates. 100% hit rates with no negative outcomes. So no accidental shootings as far as civilians being struck also. No excessive force complaints, which is really uncommon. But anyway, we'll talk about that when we have Chuck on. So anyway, Jared is shooting this individual as he's walking towards him. He can tell he's making hits because he can see the person reacting, but he's still having to shoot him. They end up grappling. Jared pulls him down, and he actually fired 3 contact shots into the gentleman's head in the middle of the grapple, and that's what ended the fight. Interestingly enough, the weapon-mounted light that was on his Glock acted as a standoff device. It was actually what made contact with the perpetrator so that the weapon was not pushed out of battery and actually continued to fire, which is another advantage of having a weapon-mounted light on a handgun if you're looking for a reason to have one. That, once again, not something that will happen all the time, but if you need it and have it, it's a lot better than not having it when you need it. Which...
Yeah. And wasn't out of those 3 shots that he fired to his head, only one of them was the lethal blow?
Yeah, I want to say the first shot was the lethal round, and then the other 2 were either glanced off of the skull, or I believe that's what happened. All 3 struck, and I'd have to either ask Jared or go back and re-listen to the episode, which I may or may not do. Yeah. But, which, once again, handgun rounds don't exactly do what you expect them to do, which could be an entire other conversation. So anyway, when we look at that, though, the reason why Jared was able to survive was because of the training that he had received and his past experiences, also the equipment that he had. If he had not been trained as well, if he had not had as much of a will to win that outcome, if he hadn't used his sights and made accurate hits after being shot multiple times,
yes.
If he had had a weapon that didn't have a weapon-mounted light on it, this is an event that is an uncommon event. Get choked up.
Still battling that kind of cold stuff.
It's an uncommon event that can really indicate the difference between life and death via training and equipment selection. Once again, one of these sentinel events that we're talking about. And I've talked with Jared about a couple of his other shootings, and obviously that one sticks out because, like I said, the first he knew it was a gunfight was when he got shot in the face. And that was over a pair of shoplifted jeans was why he was trying to arrest that individual. And he decided to try and murder a police officer rather than go to jail on a misdemeanor, which makes no sense. But, I mean, that's another indicator of the people that we're dealing with on a day-to-day basis in these sort of encounters do not think like you and I do, which is an entire different conversation. I've discussed that with William April when he's been on the show before, but something to keep in mind. So, once again, do we spend our training time on the most likely scenario, or do we dedicate just a little bit more to something that's unlikely? Do we work our strong hand only or weak hand only skills a little bit more? You know, I'm actually not very good firing weak hand only. As was demonstrated at the Polypalooza 2 conference at the charity shoot, I did horrible on that because it started off as a weak hand only thing because I hadn't practiced it because I wasn't good at it. So that's something that I've incorporated a little bit more into my training. Number one, because I don't like being bad at things. But number two, in the off chance that if I'm in an encounter, it's one that involves me having to shoot with my left hand, I want to have prepared for that a little bit beforehand. I want to have had some pre-need planning and decision-making occurring as opposed to just trying to wing it when the situation comes up. You know, another individual that we've had on the show was Justin Schneiders. I always pronounce his name. I think I get it right, but it's like such a battle to do it. But he was hanging out with a group of friends. And he actually, the interesting thing to me was he didn't carry his gun all the time before this event. He trained maybe once a month. You know, the typical gun guy. Doesn't always carry a gun, doesn't always train. And when he does train, it was just kind of blasting cardboard, you know, from 7 yards, things of that nature. Anyway, so he's hanging out in front of a law office with a group of friends. And this individual walks up, and he's got a gun. And one of the training breakdowns that occurs there, and to be clear, I'm not criticizing Justin. He survived. He made it back to his family. He saved the lives of the other people that were with him. He did an excellent job in that regards, but he got shot up pretty bad in that process, which I will talk about in a second. And this is another instance of training, maybe equipment. That can be something you decide when I talk about it. But anyway, this individual walks up on Justin and his group of friends. He's got a gun. Justin at first thinks that it's a joke. He doesn't really realize what's going on, which I think for some people that maybe have not put enough time into preparing for something like this is a pretty common reaction, but still an important thing occurs there, because honestly, it could have ended very quickly if at that point Justin had drawn his firearm and engaged the suspect perpetrator either through gunfire or verbal commands or whatever. But once again, Monday morning quarterbacking. And I'll talk about this a little bit more in the next segment. We've actually got to go to break here. Last segment, like I said, we'll discuss Justin Schneiders, and I'll kind of try and wrap everything up. Right now, you're listening to Ballistic Radio. Welcome back to Ballistic Radio, presented by Black Fire Ordnance Group, makers of TNT and TNT Black. Firearms finishes so tough you need dynamite to take them off. Visit them online at blackfireordgroup.com. So like I said, this episode we're discussing a concept that I've sort of been kicking around, the Sentinel event. And I'm using that term to describe a statistical outlier amongst what is, to me, a whole group of statistical outliers, defensive gun uses. But these Sentinel events are things that stick out as events where training, equipment, or both clearly impact the outcome of the event. A lot of times, if you're armed, that's the only thing that needs to happen. Either presenting the firearm causes the situation to be resolved, firing a shot causes the situation to be resolved, whatever the case may be. If you're armed, 99.9% of the time, you come out on top. Doesn't always happen. Before the break, I was talking about Justin Schneiders. He was hanging out with a group of individuals in front of a law office. They met every, you know, once a week, I want to say, or every other week, hung out, smoked cigars, drank a couple beers, whatever. And Justin was the typical gun owner in my mind. Goes to the range every month or so, shoots at a Silhouette, carries his gun some of the times. He happened to be carrying his firearm at this instance.
Going to say, didn't he talk about how he wasn't carrying it before, and just somehow right before he went out the door decided to grab it or something?
Yeah, went back to get it. Yeah. Saved his life probably, and the life of his friends. But so anyway, individual comes up to rob them. He's got a gun. Justin does not believe it's happening at the time, so he does not react immediately. This gentleman rounds them all up, moves them from the location where they're at, which in my mind, I'm not really going to be cool with somebody moving me to the scene of the murder, which is generally what happens when a crime moves from one location to another. If someone's moving you somewhere, that's not good. So anyway, he has all these individuals lie down on the floor of a conference room, and when the guy is distracted, Justin manages to get his gun out and lay it underneath him, and it's a 1911 Dan Wesson, I want to say. So anyway, the individual's going around getting wallets and all that. He sees Justin's holster, finds it. He's like, where's the gun? Where's the gun? Justin tells him, oh, it's in my truck. I left it because I knew I was going to be drinking or something like that. The guy pulls him up to his feet, and that's when the gunfight starts. He hears the safety being clicked off on the 1911, I think, or maybe just, I'm not quite sure which. But Justin then ends up being struck in both hands, across his stomach, and also high chest area, too. And the bad guy is armed with a five-shot Smith & Wesson J-frame, I want to say, that's loaded with 135 grain plus peak gold dots, which in general are thought of as a really effective short-barreled revolver load. In this instance, they all failed to expand, which also probably saved Justin's life. And being lucky is welcome in those situations. But Justin returns fire. He has what he thinks is a malfunction, and I will talk about that in a second. He actually clears a malfunction with both hands shot, and keeps shooting at the guy. He hits the guy in his hand and then makes one hit. They find his clothes later on. The guy was turned in profile to him, and it went through the center of his hoodie. So he was aiming center mass, but because the guy was in profile, he wasn't where center mass was, which, lucky guy. So anyway, the bad guy decides to leave because of one reason. He runs out of ammunition. That is the only reason probably that Justin Schneiders and his friends are alive today, is because that guy was armed with a five-shot revolver, had no extra ammunition. And that brings to mind another interesting thing. How long does a gunfight last? Until one of the participants is incapacitated or until one of them runs out of ammunition. So however many rounds in the gun or how long a gunfight lasts. A distinction between shootings and gunfights, too. So, and I know a lot of people start talking about capacity. Well, there you go. It is actually a really good example of what capacity does for us, because, and I'm glad that he wasn't, but if the bad guy had been armed with something that had a larger capacity, might have turned out different for him. It's a sentinel event, actually, on either side of the equation, really, which is kind of intriguing to me, at least. Anyway, so the individual leaves, the EMTs get called, Justin ends up surviving. He's stronger now than he ever was before. He actually teaches, concealed carry courses and firearms instruction in general, and takes training a lot more seriously as well. But we see a couple of things that happened here that could have positively affected the outcome for Justin. If he had recognized the threat a little bit quicker or had not been as surprised by it, possibly he would have been able to react sooner. He would not possibly, once again, and these are suppositions, but I feel pretty comfortable making them, might not have been injured at all, might have prevented all sorts of things from occurring. The other thing that happened, too, is that the malfunction that he had was not actually a bad round, but since his both hands were injured, he failed to fully engage the grip safety on the 1911. And that is one of the reasons why, and I like 1911s fine. When I have them, the grip safety is pinned specifically for this issue, is that if your hand strength is compromised, it can cause the gun not to go off when you try and pull the trigger. The other thing, too, is that in his training, he had been very used to shooting cardboard targets that were fully presented, did not move, were not reduced size targets, were not things that offered different shooting problems for him to think about as far as angles and things of that nature go. One of the reasons why he made a really good hit, but he wasn't aiming in the right place, so it didn't do anything. Things of that nature. And it goes back to the whole concept of an event that is a statistical outlier amongst statistical outliers. Most of the time, the bad guy does not stand and fight. Most of the time, they're not interested in having a gunfight with an individual. They don't want any part of that. What we have here are two cases with both Justin and Jared where, when presented with armed resistance instead of fleeing, like they oftentimes do, they decided that they were going to make a fight of it. And only through, in Justin's case, luck and the bad guy not having more than five rounds to fire at him, he survived. In Jared's case, it's very clearly an indication of the high level of training that Jared had received and also the equipment that he had available. You know, something to think about. And I'm not saying that we need to dedicate our time to these Sentinel events, but when we talk about them, I think that we need to acknowledge them a little bit more beyond all that's fantasy. It's like that Rambo fantasy that gets made fun of by people that like to use the term tactical Timmies. And I'm one of those people. I throw Timmy around all the time. But I think that we need to pay a little bit more attention to the seriousness of these issues and the seriousness of the consequences if we've not prepared for these issues. And that's kind of what I would like to do. And I'm hoping that by giving a name to it, we can treat it a little bit differently than, you know, that's just far-fetched and it's not going to happen. I think that while we don't need to dedicate massive amounts of our resources and time to preparing for, like I said, statistical outliers amongst a group of statistical outliers, it is something that we should have some thought towards when we're planning our training. You know, maybe work on distance shooting a little bit more. Work on your weak hand and strong hand only skills a little bit more. Work on targets that are at reduced percentage targets that are at different shapes. You know, 3D targets are great for this if you have the facilities to use them, where you can actually have a scoring zone that is not clearly visible to you and you just have to hit it based off of, you know, where you are in relation to that 3D representation. Long-range shooting skills, the equipment you carry, just stuff to think about. Like I said, I'm going to write an article a little bit about the Sentinel event concept and hopefully explain a little bit better. Next week, we're going to be joined by Dan Papale, who is a police officer in Pennsylvania that actually stopped a mass killing. He's going to relate the account of that day and talk about some of the lessons he learned. Anyway, make sure you check out the website, ballisticradio.com. Like our Facebook page at facebook.com/ballisticradio. Thanks for listening, everyone. As always, be safe and see you next week.